ladies and gentlemen, around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Consumer Friendly Label Show. We're sponsored by Robin Gross and Huffman Enterprises. Our host today is Jeff Gross. Gross Kenny. Jeff, how are you, sir?
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Certainly a beautiful day out.
Gorgeous.
Absolutely. And I was so excited to be here because our last broadcast, you rocked the house. I know that I can just hand the microphone over and just rock out. I'm not going to do that, but I was excited about it. It was certainly a great show, and I look forward to another one today. We've got a phenomenal guest, Dr. William Cap Ingram. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Joe.
Well, you look great, evidently, especially for a 41-year-old. Fantastic.
I think, like I said last time, I might have to give you $20 later for fibbing about me.
Well, boom. And it's amazing because you've been a physician for how long?
Around 30 years.
So since you were 10 years old, man.
That's right.
He's world-renowned. But, no, we got a great show here. We're going to obviously talk about a wide array of topics. Jeff, if you will take the reins.
Thanks, Joe. So, Doctor, it's very nice to have you here. I heard Joe introduce you as CAP.
Yes.
Tell the listeners what is CAP.
Well, it's not very interesting, but I had the same or have the same real name as my father and grandfather. And my father was insisting that I be named William Thomas Ingram. And the only way my mother would agree to that was if I got a nickname. And as it turns out, my father was a ship captain, and they call captains Cap for short. So somehow as a baby, I picked that nickname up. And so if you came up to me and said, hey, William or Bill, I wouldn't turn around.
That's funny.
If you said Cap, of course I would.
Wow.
So that's since I've been literally an infant, that's been my name.
That's phenomenal. And what is your specialty?
I'm board certified in family practice, but I am part of a physical medicine practice where we take care of people injured in car accidents, work injuries, sports injuries, and also people that aren't injured but have physical medicine type ailments.
That's great. So, one of the things that I think is very, very important is for our listeners to understand the importance of a primary care physician or a family physician. A lot of times people don't realize how important a family doctor is to their case. And I've always advocated that family doctors are great to manage a claim. Do you do that?
Yes, all day long.
All day long. And so to tell the listeners, if you don't mind, the relative importance of being able to manage a claim holistically, meaning for the entire body so that you know what's going on with your patient.
Sure. So the way I think of it is I'm sort of the quarterback. Even though I do a lot of procedures, I do joint injections, trigger point injections, and other procedures that are a therapeutic part of the recovery process when you're injured, I'm sort of a quarterback in that I will coordinate care with the physical therapy team, our specialists who do interventional injections like epidurals and that kind of thing. And of course, ultimately, if patients need coordination with care for orthopedic procedures or more advanced procedures, we have a network of people that we work with. And literally, I have most of their cell phone numbers in my phone, and I have the ability to communicate really closely with them so that people get everything that they need.
Are you able to handle a case from soup to nuts, meaning blood work, history, examination, referring out, and following up and managing it, patients' care that way?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we do. We bring a patient in that's either been seen once in the ER or never been seen after an injury, and we sit down with them. Our staff will go through a lot of paperwork, asking a lot of questions. Then the physician comes in, sits down, and asks them a ton of questions about their past injuries, past medical problems, and history of present illness, meaning what's wrong with you now, what happened, and tell me everything that you're going through. Then what we would do is typically schedule follow-up, schedule physical therapy, and whatever other kind of rehabilitative care that a patient would need. And fairly immediately we start thinking about and arranging diagnostic testing like MRIs, X-rays, CAT scans, that kind of thing. Then what we do is we get those results back, interpret them, spend a lot of time talking to the patients so that they understand what those studies, x-rays, MRIs show. I typically draw things out for people. I've been maybe accused of using too many words instead of not enough with my patients, but it ends up leaving them feeling informed. Then we will follow them every week, every 2 weeks, every month, depending upon their need, and make sure that they have all the care that they need to be as healthy as they can be after an injury.
I think one of the stronger points that you have and what impresses me about you is the ability to do pain management, though, in addition to being a family practitioner. Is that true?
Yeah, I think, years ago I did a lot of family medicine, but for many years the bulk of what I do is taking care of people in pain. And so a multifaceted approach to taking care of pain and managing pain is really what I do every day.
And so what kind of pain management do you do?
So I consider everything that we do to be pain management. So that could involve oral medications like anti-inflammatory medications, pain medications in the form of narcotic and non-narcotic pain medications, medicines that decrease nerve irritability. So there are certain types of medicines that we typically use for other things that we typically use to decrease pain. I consider to be the other things that we do, including injections, trigger point injections, joint injections, and coordination of physical therapy, even osteopathic and chiropractic manipulative care in the appropriate setting can be all things that are aimed at not just decreasing pain, but improving or restoring function.
And you have certain modalities that you use that are not just medical, or when I say medical, I mean medication or injections. I mean, you do some also hands-on therapy, right?
That's correct. We have a team of chiropractors and physical therapists that, depending upon the nature of the patient's injuries, work together or separately to help restore the patient's function, range of motion. So we're trying to get people as active as they can be as early as possible.
That's great. And so I understand that you said earlier that, I almost said you testified earlier because I'm so used to doing depositions. You said earlier that you've been doing this for about 30 years?
Something like that, yes.
That's a long time.
Jeff, can I just jump in? I want to, on that line, what you're talking about, quarterback in the case, Jeff?
Yeah. We need a quarterback in Philly. I know that.
Well, we're going to find out soon enough, right? But having said that, I tried to do it myself not long ago. I almost put myself in a grave. Didn't realize the importance. And I had a bad infection in my knee, almost lost my leg. This conversation, for laymen, having like what you're getting at and talking about, looking at it from 1,000 feet up. I went to a rheumatologist, a friend of mine, his good buddy, asked him to give me a shot in my knee because I wasn't paying attention. Nobody knew what was going on with my medications, but except my wife, and she was having a hard time tracking it. My point is, your point is well made. You'd never realize how important, particularly in an injury situation, but in a regular setting, that quarterback, that person, he's got your charts.
Absolutely.
It's vitally important.
It's very important that you have somebody that can see the forest through the trees, right? And I don't know if you knew this, but I'm a pilot also, and that's kind of what I like. I like to be able to see the forest through the trees. I like to look at the landscape. I like to see where I'm going. Ever since I was a kid, for whatever reason, I've always been fixated on knowing where I'm going. And not asking directions, by the way, because I'm a guy. but I always want to know where I'm going. And so that's what you do, really. You basically help an individual who's been injured to navigate through this process as an ally, actually. And you help them to get to the different doctors and get to the different studies that they need in order to help them and to help their case. I take it you're a good patient advocate.
Absolutely. I mean, my job is to take care of my patient and to do everything I can to help them, to make sure that I don't do anything that hurts them, and really, to be honest, when I can, to make sure no one else hurts them too.
Yeah, one of the things you said to me earlier that struck me was that when you wake up in the morning, you do everything you can not to hurt people or to help people.
Yes. Right?
So that's an important characteristic. Can you why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Well, actually, that statement really comes from the Hippocratic Oath, which says, number one, do no harm to your patient. Number two, do everything you can to help them. So if you think about it, and if you go back, 100 years or more, and you think about how many of the therapies really weren't helpful and maybe were harmful, it's important to think about everything that you do, because every choice theoretically has an opportunity to not go perfectly or to create an adverse or harmful situation for the patient. So, hopefully you don't mind me interjecting that I think about that when I think about narcotic pain medications, because I've been doing this a really long time and had a lot of in the trenches experience with people that are really suffering, and some of whom came to me on high dose narcotics, and my goal was to get them down as much as possible. But we have to be really careful to use anything and everything we can to get people better, and to limit things that can be potentially harmful.
There's no question narcotic medication has had a bad rap, and lately. And it's funny, because not funny, but it's weird how this how this occurred. Historically, people were using narcotic medication, and it got more and more and more to the point where it became this national crisis, as I'm sure you know. And then people went off on creams, and they said, well, instead of giving you a systemic modality, like a medication that's going to go into your system and affect every part of your being in order to fix your shoulder pain, we're going to put topical cream on your shoulder, because it's going to be limited to your shoulder, and it won't be systemic, and you won't feel weird effects for it, or you won't be addicted to it. And then that got a bad rap because of the cost containment provisions under the workers' comp law, which is a whole other story. And then it went to medical marijuana. And no matter where it goes, the side of the insurance companies, in case the listeners are curious, tend to put up blockages all over the place with regard to payment. And the reason they do that is because if it's not within the confines of their schedule for cost containment provisions under the law, they don't want to pay it. And so certain medications, certain creams, medical marijuana, none of that is within a cap for cost containment. I once went to a seminar where this guy came. He was a pharmacist, and he came to talk about compound creams. You know what a compound cream is,
yes,
right? And for whatever reason, the term now, compound creams, has such a negative connotation because of things like this that I'm about to tell you. This guy came into a seminar. He was dressed up like the Nutty Professor. His hair was all in disarray. He was wearing goggles. He had gloves on. He had a smock on, a white smock on. He had a crucible. And what's that thing called where you stir in the crucible? Do you know that?
Metal.
Mortar and pestle? I don't know.
Yeah, he had that.
Mm-hmm. And someone will hear this and say, that's not right, but go ahead.
He stood up in front of the audience. By the way, they were all lawyers and judges. And he said, you see this tube? This tube I bought at CVS for $19. And he squeezed the tube into the crucible. And he said, you see this tube? This cream I got at Walmart for $12.93, and he squeezed that tube into the crucible. And the third one he picked up, he said, this one is a really expensive one. It was $34.95. I got this at Rite Aid, and he squeezed that into the tube, and he mixed it all up and made a big mess out of it and pulled his hands into the crucible and picked up the crap of compound creams that were all put together, and he said, see this? This sells for $3,400. And he tried to illustrate the fact that this was not within the, because it's a compound and it's not a set cream, one cream, that it was absolutely ridiculously priced and that insurance companies shouldn't have to pay for that stuff because it's not within the schedule. So that was their reasoning for trying to discredit compound creams, and that was their reasoning for trying to make compound creams sinister. And now when someone says the word compound cream, which is now a one word, they're looked upon as being, that's a bad thing. I would never prescribe compound creams. Do you ever use compound creams?
Yeah, they're, I like them a lot. I think the whole issue, as you alluded to or said directly, is it's an issue of money. If pain creams were cheaper, the whole insanity with compound creams would never have happened. But there are certain diagnoses like complex regional pain syndrome, where I have a patient right now that we're basically unable to get him the cream he needs for that diagnosis, which is a diagnosis that creates a lot of pain, severe, unrelenting pain on the surface of his skin.
And so, for the listeners' sake, a lot of people may not know what that is, a complex regional pain syndrome. Can you just tell everybody what that
sure.
is?
Sure. The other older term is RSD or reflex sympathetic dystrophy. So it's where typically after an injury, a patient will have a hyper-excitable, if you will, sympathetic nervous system. And without getting hung up in the details of that, what it means is the nerve endings become hypersensitive. So you could touch someone with a string and it would be excruciating. Or if a patient has it in their leg, they can't have a sheet on their leg, so they have to sleep with their leg out and uncovered, even though they're cold.
And where does this usually show up? On what part of the body?
It can be anywhere, but it's in my experience, it's commonly in the extremities.
What causes it?
It usually happens commonly after a traumatic injury. So the injury causes trauma to the area, and the reaction that occurs in the body causes this abnormal.
Is it like a nerve reaction or something?
Yeah. The nerves become excitable or hyper-excitable. So you develop hyperesthesia or, you know, basically, so you become hypersensitive is another way of saying it.
How do you diagnose it?
Well, there's no really good test, so it's a clinical diagnosis. You know, people, there are certain terms, that, you know, that where you have hypersensitivity or you have an exaggerated response to a relatively mild stimulus. You know, that kind of thing. And there are other things that can happen where there's changes in the skin that can cause you to, you know, be suspicious of it and then make a clinical diagnosis. So we don't have a test that's really good. Sometimes a bone scan can be helpful, but a lot of times the diagnosis is just made based on the way the patient is presenting. And then, you know, you give them a treatment for it, and they get better.
What is the treatment for it?
So the treatment is something in the form of a compound cream. Mm. You know, certainly oral medications can be helpful too. But if you think about, and compound creams are, I think, very helpful. I've used quite a bit of them in the past, and I think they help, and they also decrease our need to prescribe narcotic, more dangerous medicines.
That's an interesting point, and kind of a big part of what you're saying too, Jeff, is that the opioid epidemic is it's killing people on a daily basis. Cap, I mean, we've made it. You cannot get, you know, you can't use CBD products for acute pain. So sometimes narcotics are important, vital. At the same time, having these alternative options that don't long term, that don't mess with the body, that don't, you know, like, in other words, having these other options alleviate that potential for addiction.
Absolutely.
And yet the work comp insurance companies, I mean, like you said, Jeff, they make up all kinds of, I mean, they have a different reason for everything.
They do. They don't want to pay. Their object is not to pay. Remember, they're a business like anything else. So they collect premiums from these businesses for workers' comp, and they try not to pay out on claims because that's how they lose money. So their income is the premiums. Their expenses is the payouts. And if they can avoid having to pay out money, they're going to do their bottom line will be better.
I wonder if they mention that when they're selling the insurance, that we're going to sell it to you. You just can't use it.
Of course not. And in fact, if you watch TV, on average, most of the commercials you'll see are for insurance companies. Everybody knows flow.
That flow and autoimmune disease. I mean, it's problem when you know. Obviously, you're the liaison when it comes to the doctors and the lawyers, and obviously, your network of medical professionals is second to none. When you're you and an attorney are looking at an injury, and you're picking a physician that is going to handle the injury. Is that a factor in what you're doing? You know, obviously, someone who can quarterback the case.
Oh, of course, we always want gatekeepers. Gatekeeper is the cornerstone of the medical case, and we look for someone like Cap to quarterback the case, get it ready. It can go to the specialist. It can go to, he helps me get the MRIs done. He helps me with the pain management. But just to touch on those compound creams, Jeff and I have been over this so many times, and we're on the same page with the compound creams. It's not that we dislike the medical properties of it, because they are proven, especially with RSD. I used it on this relenting shoulder injury that I have, but I used that a gel of some sort. But I have used a compound cream. The problem is the pharmacies. They're the ones that make it impossible for us to use it. And then I don't want to tell a doctor what to do, but it's the pharmacies that really they burned down the Golden Goose.
You're talking about because of the prices.
Yes. It was like $4,000 a month, and that's what Jeff is so upset about.
That's what upsets me.
That's what upsets him. It's not the fact that the compound creams don't work.
But because of those prices, there's been this anti-legislation for compound creams.
It's a negative connotation.
It's a very negative connotation.
Yeah, but it's a shame because they do have good success with RSD.
And the reason that the prices can be so high is because of the compound nature of these creams. They don't fit into a specific medication that's been approved either by the FDA, or maybe it has been approved by the FDA, but it hasn't been scheduled by the Medicare reimbursement rate, which is what governs how workers' compensation medical benefits get paid.
I think they also use a code that is like an unrestricted code.
Right, and so they can just maximize or set their own price.
Right.
Yeah, it's like everything else. Moderation, you know, is the better way to go. And if you think about what it takes to make a compound, the illustration that you gave earlier is I think maybe meant to be funny, but
it was.
the medications that typically go into a compound cream are actually prescription medications, you need $50,000 worth of equipment to do it. Each prescription is supposed to be done individually. You have a $120,000 employee that's actually doing it. So it is costly to do. But I think that everyone agrees that there was an excess in the way that, you know, the pricing came out on that. And the reality is I was familiar with pharmacies that were doing the same compound creams for $900. You know, maybe they had $300 in cost, and they were doing it for $900. So I think that's much less offensive than $3,400 or $4,000, really and truly, for the same thing, I would think.
Right.
And it's unfortunate because now we can't get those creams for our patients. It's sort of taboo.
Right.
And the insurance companies just deny them, and then they say, well, if you're going to fight them, you know, fight that. We're going to go to the judge, and the judges are likely to have a skewed view about it because
they are
everything
they
came before.
Right. So that's why we are moving towards this medical marijuana model, where it's a lot cheaper, A, and B, it has a very limited shelf life, and it doesn't have to be systemic. You can have a CBD cream that can be very effective, that's not considered compound, that works very well on a patient. I mean, my father uses a cream on his hip, and it works out really nicely.
Really?
Yeah.
And I imagine there's a number of different types of pain, of course, but you obviously work injury pain, but somebody personal injury pain, but also you mentioned, Jeff, about the commercials. Okay, the commercials. There's two types of commercials. They have the, you know, we're only get you what you need. You know, we've had that on a recent show. We talked about that.
Right, Limu Emu.
Right. I mean, you know, we'll that and your flow and all that. But also autoimmune disease, right? I mean, at what point, so it's either, you know, Phil Mickelson, there's, you know.
Oh, yeah, psoriatic arthritis.
Psoriatic arthritis. Yeah.
But and HIV.
Right, of course, throw that in there. Yeah, but having said that, would these creams help, you know, arthritic type pain and other types of pain as well?
I think the answer is it does help some people, and there are versions of those medicines that people can get, and even the simple one that Robin alluded to, the gel, or, you know, it's an anti-inflammatory gel. They actually really do work. And the compound creams really do work. I've had patients with great results. And so, the idea is, you know, if we can have 10 things to offer patients to decrease their need for narcotics, which in my opinion actually generally makes people worse because it blocks their pain. They don't realize what they're doing, and then they tend to injure themselves because they overdo it. But if you can have lots of different things, whether it be things that we do, percutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, chiropractic or osteopathic manipulative therapy, physical therapy, oral medications of at least 5 different types would be your choice, interventional pain injections, trigger injections, joint injections, home exercise, topical modalities, laser, heat, ultrasound, cold, hot, etc. All of those things go together to help people get better. I tell my patients, you need to do 5 or 6 things or you won't even get a little bit better. So if you do 3 things, you're not going to get better. If you do 4, you're probably not going to get better. If you do 5 of those things, then you have a shot at a meaningful improvement over time. So it's, you have to hit it from so many different angles. And that's where all of these different choices are important for us to be able to continue to employ.
Emotionally speaking, for a work injury, not any type of injury that particularly prevents you from making a living for your family, it's going to bring on emotional distress. And you're talking and anxieties. How does that affect, and I'll go to Robin, how does that affect the case when somebody is, injured and compliance is an issue because, like the doc said, they have to go through a number of different ways to attack their situation, but at the same time, getting them to understand and not have emotional issues that prevent them from going to the treatment. How do you handle that?
Very, very carefully. I mean, the emotional aspects of someone who's been injured on the job can vary anywhere from noncompliance to overcompliance to burying their head in the sand, to being depressed, to wanting to hurt themselves. I mean, it's huge. And as Jeff will tell you, it's very complicated to bring a psych claim into the case. It doesn't always happen. So we have to, in the old days, we would use pain management a lot to help with the depression. And because we didn't have psychologists and psychiatrists at our fingertips. Not that we have them now as much, but it's just a very complicated issue. And it's one, I think Jeff and I did a show not too long ago with a renowned psychiatrist, and we went over the types of psych claims.
That's true.
And it was very informative. And these people that get on comp for psych are very, very lucky.
Well, in case you don't know, I'm speaking to the listeners, there are 3 types of psychological claims for workers' compensation in Pennsylvania. The first one, which is not very difficult to get, is when you have a physical injury, and as a result of the physical injury, a mental affect or a psychological claim will arise out of that physical injury. And all you have to be able to prove is that there is a mental claim or a mental issue that arose out of the physical injury.
Like a bank teller getting robbed.
No. Like a person who has a lower back injury.
Oh, that one.
For several years and is just depressed and anxious about his future or her future, and really can't even function. And so that's that mental problem arose out of the physical injury. But for that physical injury, this person would not have been having these issues. Now, the problem that you have in bringing these claims are that there are very many people that have a psychological history or a mental history of problems. And so the defense always will try to hang their hat on a problem that's been longstanding and continues, and that this is not bringing about anything new in this individual. The other two types are more complicated, Robin. The other two types are what you had just indicated, like a bank teller who gets robbed and there's a gun to her or his head, and they say, give me the effing money, and blah, 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 blah. And next thing you know, this person has post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, the problem is if there's no injury and it's simply a mental claim based on a mental stimulus, you have to prove something called an abnormal working condition. And we're not going to get into that here, but it makes it much more difficult to bring that kind of
effect. I find that interesting, though, because you've had SEPTA bus drivers that have gotten held up, and we've talked about it in the past where there's some sort of a, I know as doctors and lawyers, this is your lingo, but some sort of a stipulation that it's in your normal course of work or something, and that you should be able to handle something like that.
And, of course, they're not going to be able to handle it. What's a bus driver going to do about a guy who's crazy?
Well, listen, I was an iron worker for 20 years, and I saw my buddy at 47th and Lancaster. I saw a crane bring up a piece of steel. Instead of coming through the building, he brought it up. It was only up like three or four floors, but he brought the crane operator brought the piece up the side of the street, the beam. They were on the outside of the building. Unfortunately, the electrical power lines are right there, and electricity arced onto the beam into his glove and knocked him off the beam into the court. Now, he lost his arm. He lived unbelievably. But the point is, I guess you could say that's in the normal course of my work because it happens a lot, but guess what?
Well, in that case, you don't have to prove an abnormal working condition because of the physical disability.
I'm talking about me, the steward. I was a mess after that.
So that's true. The bystander that watches it can get post-traumatic stress disorder. Look, the worst class of employees that this happens to is police officers because they see all this stuff going on every single day, but they really can't make a claim for post-traumatic stress disorder when they watch their partner of 20 years get his brain blown out.
Oh, my God.
Because that's part of the job. I mean, it's a real sad situation. So, Doctor, I'm sure that you see mental issues arising out of work injuries in your practice, right?
Yeah, I think literally everyone, unless there's actually something else wrong with you, meaning your inability to feel, has a problem that comes about as a result of being disabled, having your whole life turned upside down.
So, and I'm sure that not every single person who has a physical injury that's rendered disabled, not every single person is going to experience mental issues that need treatment from that, but a lot will.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, if I'm working overtime, I'm making $100,000 a year taking care of my family, and then I'm, injured, I have pain, I can't sleep, I'm taking medications that make me feel funny, I'm going to therapy, I'm unable to work, I can't do the normal things with my family, and now all of a sudden, and I don't have pay, or I'm getting 60% of my base pay, I can't pay my bills, and there's some total of all of that. It's not hard to imagine that person would be anxious, depressed, or both.
Absolutely. So as a doctor, as a family physician, when you see that emanating from a person's behavior or their emotional affect from a work injury that's physical in nature, what do you do?
Well, I mean, what we do is we try to treat everything that's wrong with people. And if we believe that someone has come to experience a depression that's medical, we treat it. So we also have a psychologist in our office, and we injured people see our psychologist, and it's really helpful. But the other thing that's good about treating depression is a side effect of that is commonly patients will have decreased pain from the antidepressant medicines.
Oh, that's interesting. I've seen that crossover.
Yes, it's really helpful.
you know, when you prescribe it for pain, people say, well, isn't this a psychotic drug? When you prescribe it for psychotic reasons, they say, well, doctor, this is for pain, isn't it?
I mean, that's right.
It's a double-edged sword. Joe, you're raising your hand?
Yeah, I am. I feel like I'm in grade school. Mr. Gross, we're going to have to go to a commercial, pay some bills. We're going to have more from the Who's Who in Philly Labor Show.
Pinnacle Medical Plus is a full-service urine toxicology and durable medical equipment company serving patients throughout the continental United States. With over 25 years of industry experience, the professionals at Pinnacle Medical Plus provide high-quality services and products combined with excellent service at a reasonable price. On the urine toxicology side, Pinnacle is a trusted partner that provides the most up-to-date therapeutic drug monitoring technology. On the DME side, Pinnacle offers an extensive list of premium products along with priority delivery services. At Pinnacle Medical Plus, their number one goal is making sure their customers and patients receive the quality care and services they deserve. Contact Pinnacle Medical Plus for all of your urine toxicology and durable medical equipment needs at 888-396-8644 or online at www.pinnaclemedicalplus.com. Suffering a work injury or any type of personal injury can be a painful and traumatic experience. What can make it even more difficult for a patient is trying to navigate and find the quality medical care they need for their particular injury. Healthmark Enterprises is a full-service medical coordination and marketing company started in 1994 by CEO Robin Lewison that takes all the worry and complications out of treatment for a work or personal injury. From coordinating full-service medical treatment with a top medical professionals, providers, and specialists to overseeing patient compliance and providing one-on-one personalized communications with clients. Healthmark Enterprises handles the entire treatment process for injured workers and those suffering personal injuries so they can just concentrate on getting better. Healthmark Enterprises believes that being injured should not limit one's access to great medical care. Now, more than ever, an injured person needs an advocate on their side. Contact Healthmark Enterprises at 215-563-1315. That's 215-563-1315. Healthmark Enterprises.
Jeff Ross is our host, sponsored by Robin Wilson. Healthmark Enterprises, who makes all this happen. Jeff's guest and Robin's guest today is Dr. Cap Ingram, fantastic broadcast, talking about a lot of good things. There's a lot of elements that go into pain, long-term injuries, and, you know, keeping somebody, Jeff, with the ability to continue to treat is often your job because we talked about the insurance companies constantly beating up on people. They never mention it. I know it's kind of a joke, but not really. In the commercials, everybody's so having so much fun. I wonder even if we had Aaron Rodgers here right now in the office, if he really knows what the hell he's promoting. Now, we need insurance, but I'm just making a point. You know, I'm just throwing it out there. I mean, you got all these celebrities jumping on. I'm sure it's good money. I'm available if you need me. I'll throw my morals right out the window.
I want to just say something. Tom Selleck. Couldn't he get a job acting? Like, why do I see
him?
He's in every creepy commercial for insurance.
Well, that's what happens to older actors.
No. Yeah.
Probably good money, though.
Probably. Yeah. I think it's all about money.
No, but that's the point. Like, you know, God knows what they put you through, Jeff. And having said that, you have to fight for their ability to be able to treat.
The good, just to the listeners, the good thing about a family doctor like Dr. Ingram is that when I have a case and I have to see the forest through the trees, it's very difficult to have to see the forest through the trees, run a law firm, advocate on behalf of my client, and micromanage their medical care at the same time. Micromanaging medical care for a client of mine isn't something that comes easy. So when you have a family practitioner like Dr. Ingram, who can basically quarterback, as he put it, the claim, it makes it a lot easier.
It's a lot of moving parts.
For a guy like me, to handle the litigation aspect of it and the overall management of it. Because remember, there's two elements to the claim. There's the litigation side, the legal side, and then there's also the medical side. So if I can rely on a guy like Dr. Ingram, I'm in good shape.
Compliance is a big issue, okay? Especially when you're dealing with emotional issues. Somebody who's literally barely can get off the couch. Talk about that.
I just like to
That's
go back.
That's why they make shoehorns.
What's that?
That's why they make shoehorns.
Yeah, it's a good point.
I mean, Cap and I have been in this business a long time, and I was really happy to meet him because he's got four or five centers geographically apart from one another. But what I liked is that it's like an all-inclusive. He really has everything under one roof. And I can make one referral, and it can go to Cap's office, and then I can get anything I need.
Where are your locations?
Our current offices are in Norristown, Pennsylvania, which I believe that's Montgomery County. Mm-hmm. The city of Chester, in between Crozier Hospital and Widener University. Then our other offices in Glen Olden, which is Delaware County, close to Clifton or Springfield. And then our last office is in Northeast Philadelphia at Grant and Academy.
Yeah, I mean, the convenience is vital when it comes to treating. It's got to be key because when you come to see your lawyer, you come to Center City, you get to the beautiful law offices of Gross and Kenny, but you're only coming here how many times? I mean,
I'm coming here every day.
I know you are, Jeff. That's important.
The truth is that with the advent of virtual medicine and virtual practicing through the pandemic, it's been, believe it or not, a little bit easier on my clients because they don't have to come all the way down here to see me. I can do a FaceTime meeting with them. I can do a regular phone meeting with them. We can use DocuSign for, executing documents. And the same holds true with doctor's appointments with the advent of telemedicine. I was going to just ask you about that, doctor. Do you also, there's two things I wanted to ask you about. One, do you do telemedicine?
We have done some telemedicine. It's the nature of what we do is so hands-on that we do it only when the patient really has no ability to get to us. So, if you think about injections and physical therapy and all of the different things that we do to help people get better, it requires them being in our office.
Well, physical therapy by nature is hands-on.
Yes.
And what about the other thing that would cross my mind is bilingual staff. Do you have anyone that speaks Spanish in your centers?
We have historically. Right this minute, we don't, but we are actively looking for a Spanish-speaking person in particular.
Okay. That sounds good. So with regard to the forest through the trees, getting back to that as a family physician, when you assess a person's condition, you assess the whole body, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you've been doing this, you said, for 30 years, so you're able to determine the disability, if there is any, as a result of a work injury.
Yes.
And so when you determine something new that's involved in an individual that they didn't come there to see you for that, but you determine that it's new, what do you do? For instance, if a client of mine has pain going down his arm and he thinks it's from his shoulder because his shoulder's a little sore, and he's got this numbness and tingling going down his arm, and then he comes to you and you start treating him for that. And by the way, that's the accepted injury. But you realize that the distribution of the nerve root that's causing the numbness and tingling in his arm and his hands is not really coming from his shoulder, but might be coming from his neck. What do you do?
Well, that's where we're like detectives. So we have to look at a patient's symptoms. If you think about where the nerves start, they start in the off the spinal cord, come out of the neck, go down into the shoulder, go through the shoulder to the upper arm, and they go through several different canals, if you will, in the elbow, and then come down through the wrist. So the nerves themselves start at your neck and go all the way to your fingertips. So we have to examine the patient and decide if they have neurologic symptoms, where the injury is. Is it at the elbow, at the funny bone nerve, which should be called a not-so-funny bone nerve? But that's a nerve that can be injured there, or it could be a C8 radiculopathy, meaning a pinched nerve coming out of the neck. So we examine the patient from the neck down, and we find out where the problem is, and it's not uncommon, actually, for patients to have shoulder pain from a pinched nerve in their neck and shoulder pain from a rotator cuff injury. So you have to work through that, too, and not assume that it's just one problem.
Right, and every once in a while I'll run into a situation where my client goes into treatment for one particular diagnosis that's the understandable, recognized diagnosis, and then there's, after several examinations and the diagnostic study, there's a determination made that it's really not that injury, but it's coming from another part of the body, like we just talked about, the neck. A lot of times, not a lot of times, but every once in a while, I find that my clients, that I don't know that that's happened because it's not communicated to me. I'm sure there's a lot of lawyers out there that there's this lack of communication between the doctor and the lawyer, or the patient and the doctor, or the patient and the lawyer, or all three. I know that you're a good communicator. What do you do when you find out that there is something different than what's the understandable injury or the recognized injury? Do you communicate that to the lawyer?
We do our best to do that, it's part of that is a function of what the lawyer's preferences are with regard to communication. Some, believe it or not, don't want to know anything until the end. Others want to be updated as they go.
I want to know everything immediately when it happens so that I can help my client. That's the best thing I can say, is I don't ever want to be an ostrich and put my head in the sand. I always want to know what's going on so I can better help my clients. So I think that communication is extremely important, not just with your clients, but also with the doctors that you are dealing with who are managing your client's pain. And so, you know, that's why it's important, I think, for an attorney and a doctor to be able to communicate effectively, like you and I can do.
I agree. And an example would be in the case that we're talking about, if we think a patient has a radiculopathy or a spinal nerve injury that's causing shoulder pain, and the accepted diagnosis may have been a rotator cuff injury, which the patient may have, but the more important problem is the neck injury, then now what we have is an unaccepted injury. And so really, whether we like to admit it or not, we need the lawyer's help, or the client will need their help to actually get the care they need.
Right, to file a petition to add the additional component that we're talking about.
Exactly.
What's that process like, Jeff?
It's always the same as it always has been. It's a litigation process. When you file certain petitions based upon the need of your client. So if we're talking about this subject matter where there's a different body part, I'll have to file either a claim or a review of the injury description to try and change that. And then that's based upon objective evidence and so forth and so on.
How long does it typically take?
The typical process for a petition generally in workers' comp is anywhere from about 9 months to a year. It can be shortened if it's recognized by the insurance carrier's doctor, which is typically called an independent medical evaluation. If that doctor recognizes, yeah, this is the problem, and they come out and they say that, which, by the way, isn't that often. But when they do, then it's resolved a lot faster by stipulation. If they don't and they maintain that there's absolutely nothing wrong with this person, then it can take longer. And the reason why it takes long is based upon the Constitution. There's under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, everybody has a right of due process, right? And so if I bring a claim, I can't just say, hey, judge, order in my favor. There has to be an opportunity to be heard by the other side. So that's why there's an IME, an independent medical evaluation, so that they can have their own doctor say, hey, this is not the case. And then it's based upon the relative credibilities of both the treating physician, my expert, and the defense doctor, the IME doctor.
Cap, I'm sure you've had situations like this. What does it make you feel like when you can clearly see somebody's injured, there's another injury involved, and somebody who spent 5-15 minutes maximum with somebody is saying it's not an injury?
It's very frustrating, and I think it's confusing to me, actually, how the process happens, because I don't even know who actually chooses what's considered to be the, quote, accepted diagnosis. And once,
I can tell you that.
Well, my sense is it's not a medical person.
Correct. So under the law, when a person has a work injury and they notify their supervisor or their employer about the work injury, they then get it then goes to the insurance company to make a determination whether they're going to accept or deny the claim. And if they're going to accept the claim, what body parts they're going to accept. And if they're going to accept the claim, what's the wage rate and the corresponding, the average weekly wage and the corresponding wage rate, and so forth and so on. So they make an initial determination. It's very, very rare that once they make that initial determination, that on paper, something changes. So once they make that initial diagnosis from the emergency room of strain and sprain of the cervical spine, you know, like you pull your neck out and you have a strain, it's very rare that once there's an MRI done and there's a herniated disc with nerve root impingement and there's numbness and tingling down the arm, that they're going to voluntarily change what they've already done and change the documentation that's been filed with Harrisburg at the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. It requires, usually, a petition. Because they're just not going to do that. Why would they increase their liability to this person more than they need to? They're trained not to do that. And so we have to file these petitions. And so when you ask the question, how long does it take? It takes about 9 months to a year on average because of the nature of the litigation and the due process right to be heard by the defense.
Cap, in that process, will you treat the injury? That secondary injury that is there while they're waiting to get that decision?
Yes, we have to. So, you know, an example would be we had a patient that had a left shoulder injury, but the accepted injury was right shoulder, and the patient had not injured their right shoulder. So
it's a great example.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the most obvious example that comes to mind. So, you know, we sent our bills in for left shoulder, and they denied them because they had – somebody had written down right, and so we treated the patient, and, you know, a year and a half later, I guess the whole thing got straightened out.
I mean, it's very difficult to diagnose the correct injury within 21 days, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous, actually. I mean, as a lay person here, what injured workers are up against is a painful thing, and I know that I thank God for the people at this table here. Because otherwise they'd be on their own, and it's frustrating how, you know, just as much as and by the way, it's a deceptive process too. I mean, is it correct? They can offer a temporary acceptance, but they could. How's
yeah,
that working?
One of the things I told you that there has to be a recognition of whether they're going to accept or deny the claim within 21 days. There's also a provisional acceptance. But they still have to file it within 21 days, and that is a temporary notice of compensation payable that gets filed by the insurance company with the Bureau of Workers' Comp. That temporary measure can extend the provisional acceptance of the claim for 90 days. So for the first 90 days, that can be completely withdrawn for any reason or no reason, without basis, with basis. It doesn't matter. The insurance company has their reasons.
How often do you get to call at the 90-day point, Jeff, because they thought they had workers' compensation and everything?
Usually it's on day 89.
Yeah.
Day 88. Usually it's just before because they don't want to look that bad.
Oh,
but they do. And it does look bad. And you have a guy that treats with a panel physician for 3 months. And just when the 3 months are just about to be up, they decide they're going to pull it. And there's really no basis for that. That's when we get into penalties and all kinds of unreasonable contest petitions, things like of that nature.
How does that affect your situation, Robin, when you're dealing with an injury and you get the and the acceptance of an injury? How do you communicate that? Does it affect?
We're in constant contact with the attorneys, but we're also in constant contact with the doctors, and we're, you know, the doctors have to treat what's injured, and it's a fine line. I mean, like I said, we depend on the lawyers to give us as much info as we can so we can relay it to the doctors. And things, as Jeff can tell you, they can turn on a dime.
It's just,
they
to
can.
Me, it, to me, th- I, you know.
And
thank,
they do.
And I always, it just confuses me every time. As a lay person, it just makes me want to, lose my stuff.
Yeah, I mean, looking at this, like I said, through the forest, looking at the forest through the trees here for this particular issue. That's why Dr. Ingram is important, because he, as a family physician, can oversee the whole issue, see what's going on, communicate it with the attorney and the patient, and then we can take the necessary steps in order to fix it.
Absolutely. So we are at the end of the broadcast. It's been the fastest hour in radio. Jeff Gross, another amazing, amazing job. I'm just going to, you know, hand you the microphone and walk out on the next one, because this has been, you're such a pro. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Who's Who and Food Show. Cap Ingram, if you would, your contact information if anybody wants to get in touch with the practice.
Yeah, our main number is 610-461-6450. And if it's a new patient, ask for Nicole.
And what's the name of the practice?
It's called the Injury Care Center, LLC.
Awesome. Robin Lewison?
215-563-1315.
Healthmark Enterprises. And our host, Jeff Gross of Gross County.
Always on my cell phone, anytime, anywhere, anyhow. 215-512-1500.
Fantastic. Listen, another one in the books. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you, Joe.
It's been
thank
awesome.
Thank you, Dr. Ingram. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Cap Ingram, for a fantastic job. And I want to thank Robin Lewison for making it all happen. This has been the Who's Who in Philly Labor Show, sponsored by Robin Lewison and Healthmark Enterprises. For our host, Jeff Gross, and our guest, Cap Ingram, and our fantastic sponsor, Robin Lewison, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks so much for listening.